So who wants to take up what happened in Village Green, which, not to be confused with Village of Cambui, a Sixth Circuit decision? No one? No one? I'll take that one. It was basically the same facts as the Village of Camp Bowie. It was Fannie Mae being crammed down, and there were, I think it was like 30-some-odd general unsecured creditors, maybe even less. They were being paid a nominal amount. The payment was stretched out over two payments in 6 months. The debtor said, this is impairment. Fannie Mae came in and said, well, no, that's contrived. That's artificial impairment. You can't do that. The Sixth Circuit, citing Village Camp Bowie and L&J Anaheim, said, well, you know, it is impairment. No concept. There's no such thing as artificial impairment. So it satisfies 1129.810. But there are other factors at play here. Just as the Fifth Circuit warned, you still have to prove good faith. And there's some issues with this plan. Like, the debtor has tons of cash based on the way that they're cramming down Fannie Mae. They have plenty of money every month. They can pay these creditors. There's no reason to stretch them out. The debtor didn't meet the standards of good faith, and so confirmation was denied, even though they satisfied 1129.810.
And so one of the things I like about this approach, and I alluded to it earlier, is in subcom, where it's not straight from the statute, it's sort of a created idea, under the equitable powers, where good faith is sort of one of the factors that courts look at. Here, when we're dealing with a standard that's written right into the code, you don't have to impute good faith into the impairment analysis. You can just go to the other code section that says look at good faith. And so it makes sense that when you're dealing with something that is just straightforward in the code, you just look at the text of the code. And when you're dealing with subcon, which is not based, directly in the words of the code, that you can create a test where one factor is that element.
Fannie Mae laid a trap in that case, too. If anyone reads, it's a three-page opinion. It's worth reading. Fannie Mae actually went out and offered to pay these creditors in full, immediately. And the creditors said, no, we'd rather get paid in two installments over 6 months and we'll just support the debtor's plan. And the court actually looked at that and said, that shows that these creditors are really just siding with the debtor and it looks kind of contrived. So it's kind of an interesting factor. We'll move on, unless you have anything else on artificial impairment. Let's move on to per plan versus per debtor. And what I mean here is when you're voting on a plan, if you have an impaired consenting class as a whole, even though you have 100 plus debtors, does that work? Or do you have to have an impaired consenting class for 100 debtors?
For each of them, yeah. And so we were talking about this earlier, and I was saying one of the first things I was ever taught was don't file something for bankruptcy if you don't have a plan to get it out. And so, you're always doing that impaired accepting class analysis of who's going to be my impaired accepting class here. And so we never rely on this per plan approach. And we're also talking about it again as cases have evolved from the Augie Restivo type cases where it's very simple, two entities, to these large corporations with potentially hundreds of debtors. The sort of notions of equity and fairness that a single impaired accepting class at a very small subsidiary of a huge debtor structure could be sufficient to cram all other classes at all other debtors. There's something that don't hold me to it. I might try it one day, but it doesn't always doesn't really feel right. Right, that the smell test that was mentioned before, something about it doesn't quite seem to comport with the notions of equity and fairness. But there have been some recent cases, the Transwest case most recently, out of the Ninth Circuit, looking at this issue, and so sort of re-sparked the conversation. And again, it's interesting. There's two different textual interpretations
of the same language,
which just goes to show that there must be ambiguity in the language. With some courts, like the Tribune Court, saying that the unambiguous text says that it must be on a per debtor approach, and then the Transwest Court saying the unambiguous text says a per plan approach is fine.
Yeah, I enjoyed that because the Delaware courts, the Tribune, and then there was the Juror Jameson court that are both looking at Section 102.7, which is, it's not a provision of the code I look at often, but it actually tells you how to interpret the code, and it says something like the singular includes the plural. And so the Transwest case, the Ninth Circuit says, yeah, we looked at that. All that means is you substitute a debtor for debtors, and we come to the same result. And yet Delaware is saying, no, but if we use that, we come to a different result. I found that interesting.
Yeah, and I think for the courts that go for the per plan approach, I think, again, we go back to the good faith analysis mm-hmm. because, you know, Alex, to your example, you know, if you had one small, you know, class at an obscure subsidiary,
smaller entities,
then, you know, probably it's going to be very difficult to cram down the much larger classes.
You have to have a really good reason for why that's how you're structuring.
Yeah, I think you're going to have a really good story if you're going to try and do that.